Paul Simon.
Oh, that's Paul Simon. Oh,
Yeah.
But
Simon, Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah, we're not complaining, though, right?
No.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, Texas, at that same number. You know, Sandy, those, at the time that those songs were written and performed, the nation was
ripped up,
inside out and upside turned, inside
absolutely
out and upside down.
That was all about. That was at the height of the Vietnam demonstrations. I would just put that at about 1970.
Yes,
which is right at the height of that. I would guess that that's within a year of that.
So the civil unrest just coming out of the civil rights issues in the country.
The two of them, Simon and Garfunkel, went to Columbia, and they were there at the time of the big Columbia demonstration. I was there at the same time, and that was wrenching. That was the beginning of the college demonstrations and the wrenching experience, societal experience related to the Vietnamese War.
You know, Sandy, and going back to those epic points in the history of the nation and the growing time, it was, you know, the greatest generation was, and then was actually starting to get moved a little bit more by the younger voices.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the boomers, well, we were such a big generation, and we had by that time become dominant socially. We were a very big focus for marketing, even at age 18 or 19 or 20, which was the beginning, the leading edge of the baby boom. By that time, the baby boomers were flexing their muscle, and that was part of the whole demonstration thing. And the youth versus elder kind of experience that occurred, you know, with the greatest generation supporting the Vietnamese War and the baby boom basically asking questions and being very concerned about it. What's interesting to me is that baby boom generation that was asking questions about government at the time, as it's matured, has become this highly polarized generation with essentially the Trump right being heavily,
right,
heavily populated by baby boomers. We're a complex generation in a way, and we have never given up control of the country. We continue to control it. We've got a guy in the White House who's even earlier than the baby boom generation, but he reflects the fact that we still control the wealth of America and we control the political levers.
You know, Sandy, and I recall the baby boomers kind of overwhelming the greater generation and saying it's our turn, and pushing and moving and moving and kicking doors in. And now we're on the other side of it. The millennials are now kicking the doors in.
Yeah, but it's taken a much longer time.
Much longer.
The period of time that our generation has been in control is taking us into our dotage. You know?
Well, so it does go to what I was talking about towards the end of last Friday, and that was this fact that the millennials are getting ready to inherit, you know, the largest inheritance of any time in history. $58 trillion is what they pegged, and that the average baby boomer is worth $1.2 million, while the average millennial, and people need to understand, some millennials are almost 50 years old, are only worth $100,000.
Yeah, we should all have food. We should all have people tasting our food before we eat it.
Sandy, don't give them any ideas.
Yeah, I know. No, I mean, it's to be honest with you, I think that's a sorry commentary that we've controlled the wealth so greatly, and that, like I've said before, we're the generation that pulled the ladder of success up behind us in many respects. You can just measure it in so many different ways, and the net worth of people is a good way to measure it. And the average net worth of the baby boomer is, and I'm confident that in real dollars, when we, the boomer generation, were 50, we had a higher net worth in real dollars than the current generation does, because, you know, we have not done a good job of making sure that our children and grandchildren do better than we do. I, you know, it's, in another show we can talk about it, I was listening to a Chinese banker on the radio today, and they were talking about, and the Chinese culture is much more embedded with children and grandchildren thoughts,
right,
than we are. And to the extent we talk about it politically, it's all lip service, because our actual conduct belies it, okay? Our actual conduct shows that what we're interested in is essentially satisfying our current wants and needs and greed.
Let's go to the phone lines, and Tom from L.A. Hey, good morning, Tom. How you doing, man?
Hey, good morning, guys. First off, we the people ultimately are the government, and we must never forget that. Second, I'm really looking lately at even the younger generation, and I'm telling you, Ronald Reagan destroyed this country. He took us from a country of
creditors,
community. Yeah, well, that too, but he took us from an idea of community to survival of the fittest. I guess I'm okay with survival of the fittest because I'm going to survive, but survival of the fittest rather than community. I hear younger generations, even the new generation, you know, saying that they're about community and stuff, but they're also about, I'm going to get mine and basically, you know, forget about everybody else. And I don't know how we're going to switch this back to, I mean, one, it's going to be, have to be from the survival of our nation. But I don't know how we switch things back to the idea of community, the idea of looking out for your brother or sister without having the fear of you're going to lose everything. Cause that's exactly what's been set up in the game of politics. I mean, even back then, like you're talking about with Bridge Over Troubled Waters and some of those different songs and stuff. Well, now we'd be told you don't talk about politics when, you know, in polite company, and you don't talk about religion or politics, blah, blah, blah. It's like everything has to do with religion or politics in terms of where we are as a country. And I don't know if that even started, you know, around the Ronald Reagan era or what, but it just seems, like I said, I grew up through the Ronald Reagan era, and I don't remember anything before that. But it sure seemed to me like there was a lot more sense of community and everyone working together, more so than I got mine, screw you. Just like these basketball players and football players, you know, always going and pointing at themselves and hitting each other, hitting their own chest when, yeah, when they do something. It's like me. I mean, we have something called the iPhone, you know, everything is I. And it's, you know, we were taught to have self-love, but went to an extreme of narcissism.
Hey, Tom, selfies, you know, so, I mean, selfies. You see people,
yeah.
I've never taken a selfie. Okay. I refuse.
Well, I can understand, Earl.
All right, Sandy. But I refuse to take a selfie. I mean, just the whole.
Well, the name is the yes. Word is the word. You're right. iPhone selfie. You know, you're onto something, Tom. I do think that even the vernacular of our current generation is so self-centered, and the lack of community is manifested, I suppose, by people dealing with one another on their phones, you know, never interpersonals. You know, the idea of having personal contacts with one another is almost abhorrent. And young people, I coach a bunch of high school boys rowing, and we're on the bus going someplace. They'll be sitting on their phones, and they'll be texting to one another, and they're sitting next to the people they're texting to. It's like, really?
Yeah, it's
just remoteness. It's individual remoteness.
And the thing about it is, if you look at developmental in terms of psychology, you know, babies are the ones that are all about me, 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 me.
Right.
They need someone to care
right.
for them. And the thing is, somewhere along the line, all of a sudden, we have grown up, and we have even the past occupant of the White House that acted like he was a 12-year-old. I mean, there is something really, really wrong where it is just about me.
Hey,
I think we really need to make a shift.
Hey, Tom, man, thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it. You know, Sandy, there's no question he has something there. And yes, that is the way of today's world.
Well, I think the boom generation, the boomers, were the start of it, because we have been a very greedy generation. And like I said, when you look at the politics of our generation, it's all been about the short term. It's a tax cut for tomorrow. It's not about saving the environment for our grandchildren. It's about worrying about today's job and today's profits. And we just have given up on a culture of worrying about our children and grandchildren. We talk about it, but we don't really do it. And I'd have to lay that at the feet of our generation. We're the generation that caused our children to take on student debt instead of paying for it themselves, instead of paying for it out of our pockets like our parents did. So, you know, I think that all of us baby boomers on our deathbeds should have a lot of remorse about what it is we're leaving behind. And we ought to be acting feverishly now to make amends for what it is we've done.
So, Sandy, when we get back, we want to talk about, again, you know, what's happening with the banks. Didn't get a chance to do it, but we're talking about all of these different things that are going on in when Sandy left. But we're looking for the solutions, and the solution is in the studio. Got to go to a break. We'll be right back.
This is the Beatles.
And anytime you feel the pain, hey Jude, refrain. Don't carry the world upon your shoulder. For well you know that it's a fool who plays it cool.
You know, the lyrics is really where they were headed.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the lyrics to all of those. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy Williams is back, and all is right with, well, not quite.
No.
He didn't change the weather. Can you do something to change that weather, Sandy?
Boy, you'd think so, huh? No. No,
you can't do that. Huh?
Just wish. If wishes could come true, maybe. But you know, I tried to blame you for the failure of the Republic Bank. But actually, I was back in the States, and maybe it was me coming back that caused the problem.
So, Sandy, explain, because I remember when that other bank.
Well, Silicon Valley Bank failed, and Signature Bank and the East Coast failed.
And you, I remember you distinctly saying, "That's not a sign that the other banks are going to follow suit."
Well, you know, but I've explained, banking is overall dependent upon the confidence of the people who do banking. You know, the people who put their money in banks have to be confident because the bank it's called fractional banking. You put a $100 deposit in a bank, and they immediately turn around and lend out probably $50.
But Sandy,
so they don't. If everyone put $100, if everyone put their money in the bank today, and everyone showed up at the bank next month to take the money out, it wouldn't be there.
But Sandy, I'm confident with the bank that I'm working with. Mm-hmm. That they're going to be fine, but I don't know the inner workings of what they're doing. How confident can I be?
Well, that's why the FDIC was set up, so that if you have less than $250,000 in the bank, the government's going to stand behind that bank and you're going to get your deposit back. So they essentially made banking pretty easy for the bankers because the bankers can attract money, and the money they attract, they pay almost no interest for. They get it for free from you. You have it there so you can write checks and basically deal with the currency. And they have it so they can lend money out and make profits, and they can invest the money how they see fit. And that's the part we don't know too much about. And that's the part that the Fed is supposed to be regulating. The Dodd-Frank Act, the Glass-Steagall Act that was repealed, there were a lot of things that were designed to make bankers not act in a way that put money at risk so that there was a good deal of security in banking that went beyond just the FDIC insurance. And, you know, then what we had was a set of conditions that caused, for instance, Silicon Valley Bank. So they had huge deposits from all of these startup companies who might have started out with less than $250,000, but as they got more successful and as they became loyal bank customers, they kept their tens of millions of dollars of deposits in the one bank. And so they had lots. The Silicon Valley Bank had something like 80% of its deposits were in excess of the $250,000 guarantee number. And so they were at risk. And so when there was even a chink in the armor of confidence on the part of the people banking with Silicon Valley, they went to get their money out. And as soon as people start taking money out of a bank, at any kind of a rapid clip, it puts the bank in jeopardy. The bank has to do things to fortify its capital, to find cash. They got to borrow money from the Fed. They go through these processes, some of which are public. And when the public gets the smell of this, the run gets even worse. And bingo, Silicon Valley Bank goes from doing all right to being belly up in the space of days. Signature Bank was dependent on cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency has a lot of risks inherent with it. It went under for that reason. This most recent one, First Republic, is a California-based bank that also was dependent on very large deposits based on having the deposits of very wealthy people in California. They made their lending was in large part super mortgage lending to people who had $10 million houses. And so it was a bit of a unique bank itself. But, you know, the banking system is under some stress. And, you know, there's a list of banks that are experiencing some stress. I was sort of surprised to see U.S. Bank and others. It's a long list of not very stressed banks. But the stock market is not penalizing banks very much now. They're believing that the risk is low. The rate at which deposits were withdrawn from banks over the last while had slowed way down, except for Republic Bank.
So, Sandy, hang on to that thought. 844-967-2789 is the number. Got to go to a break. We'll be right back. So let me ask you this.
In times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Monday, and that means Mondays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. Glad he's back. We're talking about the banks and where they are. Let's go to the phone lines and CJ. All right, CJ.
Thanks, Earl and Sandy. Glad you had a good trip, Sandy. Yeah, they bailed out Silicon Valley because they were huge donors to the Democrat Party. And Janet Yellen, in front of the Senate Finance Committee, couldn't remember what she had for dinner
let me just ask a question. You said that they bailed out the bank. They didn't bail. Signature Bank doesn't exist anymore. It wasn't bailed out.
Silicon Valley Bank.
Silicon Valley Bank was not bailed out.
Yes. They did too. What are you talking about?
The FDIC put it in receivership.
Are they going to do the same for the small bank?
No, the FDIC. Wait, the FDIC put it into receivership, and the bank itself wasn't bailed out. The depositors in the bank were protected, but the bank wasn't. I mean, I just want to get our terms correct. The shareholders of Silicon Valley Bank lost everything, and the Silicon Valley Bank was not bailed out, but its depositors were protected. Okay? That's what happened.
Big depositors, yes. So get the facts right, Sandy. Well, they did bail out the depositors.
Well, no, you said they bailed out the bank. I had the facts right, but go ahead.
Okay, but regardless, that up, it was asked the question of the secretary, Janet Yellen, are you going to do the same for the small banks? She is a disaster. This Biden thing, the Republicans put forward a responsible budget cutting back to 2022, but the Democrats and Biden will keep the debt ceiling as a campaign issue, like they always do.
Well, tell me,
like every issue.
Tell me this, CJ. We should talk in shorter sentences. So the Republicans put forward a responsible program. What tax increases did they suggest to decrease the deficit? Because, of course, deficits are caused both by a shortage of revenue and a surplus of expenditures. And ever since the tax cut under Trump, the deficits have gone up. And that tax cut itself resulted in an immediate deficit the next year. So wouldn't you say that a responsible program would also include tax increases?
You want to create more inflation? Go ahead, Sandy. Your party's really good at it.
Well, taxing. Wait, just a minute, CJ. Let's just get to economics one. Tax increases are deflationary, not inflationary. Okay, so we're not going to create inflation by increasing taxes.
Really? Well, we're living your tax increase right now. It is a tax increase on every item that we buy, from eggs to cars to you name it. So the mere fact that you speak in lingo that it didn't cause it, we're living your tax increase. Oh. It's on the small people. inflation hurts the small people. And you want to raise taxes? Yeah. You want to create more inflation. You want to create more dependency on the government. That's exactly what the Democrat Party lives, breathes, and believes, that the big man's going to pay for it. People who didn't go to college should pay for people who did. And it's 101. We're living 101.
Did you get it off your chest?
So, CJ, let me just ask you, did you hear before, do you know what percentage of the American population families earn more than $250,000 a year?
Well, God bless them if they do.
Well, do you know what percentage? Do you know what percentage in the American economy that is, though?
Do you know what the cost of eggs are today compared?
No. I just want to. You want to talk about the big man and the small man, but actually, well, the number that I found, and I'm going to do some more research to confirm it, but was 2%. 2% of American families earn more than $250,000. That means 98% of the families earn less. So you're talking about the big guys paying for the little guys and all of this talk, but it's defied by the facts. Yes, we're having inflation, and yes, inflation is most painful for those with the lowest incomes, for whom necessities take a higher percentage of their income. So there's no question about that. But that argument doesn't solve any problems, CJ. We're on this show, what we're trying to do is solve problems. And I guarantee you that the proposal by the Republicans doesn't solve any problems for Tom, Dick, and Mary. Okay? It threatens Tom, Dick, and Mary with a reduction in benefits. It does nothing more than is currently ongoing to reduce inflation.
The Inflation Reduction Act didn't reduce inflation.
Okay. CJ, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Don from Milwaukee. Good morning, Don. How you doing? Thank you very much for the call. You say what, sir?
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. This is a very interesting show. Gee, I'm glad Sandy's back. I wanted to have him explain to me what is the Glass-Steagall Act. I've heard of it so many times, and I'd also like to know if that were enacted today, would that help save the banks? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Great question, Don. Thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, Glass-Steagall was an act that was enacted during the Depression, and it was basically enacted as part of a compromise that created the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And what it said was that, yes, banks, we are going to guarantee the deposits of your depositors, which will make it far easier for you to get deposits into your banks and will keep you in operation. And in exchange for that, banks, you are going to be restricted in the businesses that you can do to basically lending money to Tom, Dick, and Mary, to lending money. You can take money in and you can lend it out. You can make commercial loans. You can make industrial loans. You can make retail loans. But you can't use the money to invest for your own account. So in other words, a bank would not be allowed to make investments in the commodity market. They would not be able to buy stocks for their own portfolio. They would not be able to do a bunch of things that might increase their profits, but would also increase the risk profile of the money that they were using for making those investments, that money being the deposits of the depositors. That act was repealed during the Clinton administration, and ever since then, banks have been free to use the money that they bring in for deposits in many, many ways. Invested in U.S. Treasury instruments, which is part of the problem that the Silicon Valley Bank has had, because they invested in long maturity types of instruments. So the Glass-Steagall Act basically said, "Yep, we'll guarantee your deposits through the FDIC, but you in turn promise to be bankers and essentially nothing else. You're going to be commercial bankers." And you're not going to do anything else. And after the Glass-Steagall Act, banks were able to do almost everything that investment banks and other kinds of higher risk profile companies have done.
You know, Sandy, signs, you know, that there are signs that kind of are leaning towards there being some difficult times economically. Coming, maybe not recession, but there are some signs that things are, the economy is slowing down. That there are some layoffs, and I know I've been trying to nudge you over the last several years about, you know, the signs and layoffs and recession coming, and you've been pushing back. No, it's not. No, I don't see recession. No, we can soft landing. You still?
Well, we're currently in something that, if it were to continue like this, is a soft landing. But the question is, will it continue softly, or are we getting into a position where it's going to become more difficult? The Fed is likely to increase interest rates again, which will take them up to an 18-year high in terms of the federal discount rate. And so that portends a somewhat of a tightening in the economy. This bank problem is causing the banks to pull in their horns and to be more restrictive on the loans they make. That withdraws money from the economy, makes it harder for businesses to borrow money, makes it harder for them to hire people, makes it harder for Tom, Dick, and Mary to borrow the money to buy a car, et cetera. So, you know, we are definitely on a downward trajectory in terms of the rate of activity in our economy. And the question is whether that this will be a smooth landing or whether it will be breathtakingly difficult and jarring.
So the Fed is saying that 4.4%, even though the interest rates have really come down from the 9% that they were, 4.4%, and I'm thinking, well, that's okay. And they say, no, they think 2.2 point whatever it is.
Yeah, well, 2% has been the goal. There's been talk on the street and in the financial community, gee, maybe they ought to raise this goal to 3%. I think in the past it had been 3%. It was reduced to 2%. So the Fed has this goal for inflation that is currently 2%, and 4.5% is more than double that. So, they're saying now that they want to slow inflation down. But, you know, what they probably do want to take some of the starch out of the economy, and they aren't willing to say that exactly. But I continue to believe that there is enough upward thrust under the economy. The loss of value in the dollar, okay, what has been talked about today and more recently is the fact that the dollar has been declining in its value against other currencies. I mean, in the long run, I'm a little worried about that because it could be the leading edge of the dollar losing its status as the global currency, okay? But in the near term, the reduction in the value of the dollar makes all of our exported goods cheaper, makes it easier for us to export goods, makes it more expensive to import goods. So it could increase the price of products in the United States somewhat, could be somewhat inflationary, but it also could provide for more jobs because the companies we have that are manufacturing things for export will export more. And also the international businesses will achieve higher dollar earnings because they'll get more dollars per euro of earned money, for instance.
So the fact that the prices of the products will go up and that will help the businesses, the prices going up doesn't help the Tom, Dick, and Mary.
No, the fact that the dollar value is going down is in fact an inflationary influence in our economy, and so it could exacerbate the inflation, and it could require that the Fed continue to be more aggressive about interest. Personally, I'd be more interested in the government being more aggressive with its fiscal policies and the tax increases and other deflationary things be done which aren't as damaging to Tom, Dick, and Mary. But right now, our economic policies seem to focus on the tools of monetary policy.
So, Sandy, so is... why am I having Milton Friedman? So economists, it's not an exact science, right?
No, not at all.
Because when I hear these debates that these guys are having, you know, it could go one way or it could go the other way. And the guy simply, it sounds solid what he's saying. On the one side of it, the other guy's stuff sounds solid.
Yeah. Economists use math that makes it seem like it's precise, but the math is filled with assumptions that aren't precise.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So... Somebody making that song today. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Sandy Williams is back.
I'm back.
Yeah.
So you know it's interesting. All these songs you play, you realize how much more the lyrics were involved with kind of the political lay of the land during the day. All of these songs were all about those kinds of things, policy things, and political and international affairs, and today's songs, not so much.
You know, Sandy, just the music, and even in the genres of music that I was listening to, all of them had at the base of it, you know, political issues that were impacting and affecting, and the lyrics.
Yeah.
Were the story.
And about the only thing that's got that going now, I suppose, is rap. The rap is the one that, and it's not the same.
It's
more of a social commentary.
Yeah.
But, we were talking about the economy and where are we headed? And, it's not clear where we're headed, but I think what's going on now, people are going to look back in time, the decline in the value of the dollar at a time when the dollar is under attack by the international trading community, in terms of a greater number of people wanting to become less dependent on the dollar for trade, and that dollar as the world currency is a fundamentally very important thing to our economy. I've been listening to the Wall Street Journal and reading the Wall Street Journal and others, and everyone doesn't want to open their eyes to the notion that the dollar could be at risk, because it's such a fundamentally important thing and we've taken it for granted. Just like starting in 2008, we started taking for granted, 1% or zero interest rate. When it started happening, we all said, how can it possibly be? We were all used to 7% interest, and now it's 1? Really? And so, but now we're all used to 1, and now it's like 7? It could really get to 7.
Well, Sandy, you say we don't know where it's going. We clearly know that it's not going to be reversing itself immediately and going back to those great times we just had.
The interest rate, just the great time. One thing that is clear is that the world, we thought the world was going into recession, and it seems to be defying the odds on that. And we've only got a couple of countries in the world that would qualify as in recession. China seems to be pulling itself back together pretty quickly. And interestingly, the head of South Korea comes to the United States, and in the United States gets a warm reaction. But in South Korea, there was a great deal of criticism of the trip. The reason being that South Korea is the biggest trading partner of South Korea is China. And South Korea is very intent on not getting crosswise with China. China is, we should all understand, and we should start developing a foreign policy and a view of things that gives credit to China for the important player it is in the world, and not be threatened by it, but rather learn how to deal with it. And I fear that our current reaction is to feel the threat and believe that we can take actions to continue domination. And that domination isn't just economic. It ends up converting into military and, and other kinds of domination, which are exceedingly dangerous and exceedingly expensive.
You know, Sandy, I didn't get a chance to talk about it, but I was going to talk about the fact that the business community, the federal government, is starting to relax and hire people who have had drug issues.
Yeah.
You know, and we're talking because they have no choice. This decisions that were made that if you couldn't pass a drug test, that you somehow were criminal.
Well, of course, the fact that marijuana is now legal in like 20 some states.
It just doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't
anymore,
make
right?
any sense to disqualify workers who, with your current workforce, wouldn't pass the drug test that you are not disqualifying a bunch of potential applicants for. So, you know, I think the world maybe is changing its view on that kind of thing.
Well, we do know that the business community is, because they're the ones who are saying, hey, Earl was a good guy. I mean, I looked at his, he had everything right.
Yeah.
But he didn't pass the drug test, and not because his urine sample. I'm talking about from a hair follicle that says 30 days ago, the guy smoked a joint. Well,
yeah,
that's reason enough that you eliminate that guy or that young lady. And that's the way it's been, Sandy. And the fact that they need people so badly, the fact that they're looking at that is a good thing. Would you agree?
Well, it is a good thing. And also the fact that our prisons were essentially, in some respects, filled with people who had committed crimes that were associated with that same drug.
Yeah, right.
And wouldn't be crimes today, or at least they wouldn't need to be. So, you know, hopefully our society is going to begin to adjust to reality. But you can see that it does it only in fits.
Right.
Because look at all of the kind of silliness we're going through with respect to transgenderism and things that are less than the top
priorities.
Issue, top priority, yeah.
You know, Sandy, it is absolutely disheartening when you keep saying we've accepted 14-year-olds in factories. And change the children laws that allow younger people to work in jobs that they shouldn't have.
Really? We've changed the
child
labor is being relaxed?
Yes. Yeah. The Republicans pushed it. I talked about it last week, and you and I will talk about it Friday. They've changed many of those laws because they're saying we don't have any other choice. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you can't say that it's okay for a 14-year-old. I was dealing with some people talking about labor.
There are millions of people on the border who want to come into the country and do those jobs, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. But anyway, Sandy, it's good to see you back, my friend. Thank you.
Good to be back. And
it's
fun.
We got to go. Thank you, everybody who made the show go. I'll be back on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Thank you very much, Calvin. See you guys later. Keep your comrade warm. I'm back in the USSR. Hey, you don't know how lucky you are, boys. Back in the USSR.